We're continuing our sermon series through the life of David. We're going to be in 1 Samuel 17. So if you want to open up a Bible and turn to that chapter, we'll get there in a second. But before we do, we need to acknowledge that we live in a world of giant problems, don't we? You don't need me to like run down the list for you. You know the list. I know the list too. There are irrational and violent wars waging all over the world. There is political, there is ideological division and tribalism much closer to home. There's inflation, there's economic uncertainty, there's ecological mismanagement. It's 2023, it's 1983, it's 1063. It's just the way the world is, right? There are giant problems that we face. And that's just the stuff out there. Okay, that's just the stuff far beyond any one of our personal realms of influence. Then there's all the stuff that we deal with when we wake up in the morning too, right? We are all carrying giant problems with us through our lives. Maybe they're health challenges for you. Maybe they're challenges with kids or parents or coworkers. Or maybe it's those challenges at work where someone hands you a project and you're like, there is no possible way I am able to do this, and yet it's my job to do this, so I guess I just go do this, right? Here's my question for you as we launch. When the gigantic problems begin to build up in your life, how do you react? Like, what's your reaction to the giant problems that we face, or that you face personally? How do you react when the challenges seem insurmountable, unbeatable, and overwhelming? I think there are a number of ways that people react to giant problems. Here's a couple, all right? See if any of these fit. Maybe you are the kind of person who like doubles down and gets even busier, okay? And like hustles even harder because to address the problem. So you're the one who like wants to be well-read on the issues of the day, to like up to speed on the latest injustices or the latest maybe irrational attempts by that other political party to impose their will that's just gonna be chaos, you know? Into our lives so that you can stand up against it, right? You're like working against the giant problems. You work and you fight to protect your family from these influences, but the enemy is just like never lose energy, and you absolutely do. And maybe you get weary, hustling harder to address the enemies. But the fight must go on, so you get up the next day and you do it again, all right? Maybe that's you. Or maybe you get cynical. You've seen it all before. Nothing surprises you anymore. Nothing moves you, even if it should move you, even if it should. Another lying politician, I could have told you about that one, right? Another unjust war, those are always happening. Another fight with your spouse, that's just the way he is, or just the way she is. I know how this world works. Trust me, I've seen it all. I'm not impressed. And you get seared, right, to the world. You get cynical. Or maybe you're the kind of person who just checks out. Okay? You just check out. Not completely, because no one can completely check out of life, right? Otherwise, like, you just get buried by life. But you check out as much as you can. So emotionally, you're just not willing to engage the issue, even if it needs to be engaged. You know what I mean? Maybe you are living life in such a way that you're basically searching for just some simple comforts, and these giant problems, there's nothing comfortable about them. So you ignore it, or you defer it, or you kick the can down the road, or you lie down in the face of it. I actually think this last one is kind of common in our valley. I mean, they all are. But in some ways, our valley, there's like this default mission for our lives to be basically like work hard so we can play hard. You know what I mean? And both good things in and of themselves. I'm all for good hard work, and I'm all for good hard play, trust me. But when the mission of our lives becomes being comfortable and having fun, the idea of taking on more burden than is necessary, stepping into a fight with giant problems, it doesn't make much sense. Like, there's not a bucket for that in that kind of a mission for your life. I'm good right here, thanks. I'm kind of path of least resistance, all right? I find all of these reactions to giant problems alive and well in my own heart, all three, even though some of them directly contradict each other. And I'm curious which of them you might resonate with as well. Maybe you can relate. God's people have always faced giant problems. We live in a broken, damaged, hurting world, and we always will. This is just part of our journey this side of heaven. But there may be no more famous encounter with a giant problem than the one in our passage today, the story of David and Goliath. You can put the metaphor away. God's people face a literal giant today in our story, all right? 1 Samuel 17 is a pretty long chapter. We will read lots of it. We're not going to read all of it. We're going to read a bit and kind of talk through what the author is showing us and then read a bit more. So it's going to be kind of a rolling read and discussion like that. So as we go, though, keep this question in mind, all right? Where do you see yourself in this story? There are a number of characters who react to the giant problem in a number of different ways. Which one are you most like? And what is God offering you when facing the giant problems in your life? All right? So that's where we're heading. Let me start us off in verse 1, 1 Samuel 17. Now, the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Succah, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Succah and Azekah, in Ephes Damim. Oh man, I should have practiced these before I started. Okay, my advice to everybody is like, just say it with confidence and you're right. Like it literally doesn't matter how it sounds. So just say it with confidence. All right, and Saul, who's the king, and the men of Israel were gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up in line of battle against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with a valley in between them. All right, so you can kind of see the scene, right? You can kind of get a feel for how this is going to go down. The Valley of Elah is this valley that runs down towards the Mediterranean Sea in Israel, and there's a creek down at the bottom, and on one side are the Israelites who God has promised this land to. Like, they're standing on the land that God has promised to them, and they've taken so much of it. They've driven out their enemies. They've defeated them, and yet they've left some there, and so these enemies are constantly coming back like a stone in their shoe, and there's always conflict, and the most persistent enemy and the most violent one is the Philistines, and they're on the hill opposite them, and they're staring at each other, all right? Pick it up in verse 4. There came out of the camp of the Philistines a champion, remember that word, named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits in a span, probably something like 9 feet tall. And he had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze armor on his legs and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of the spear was like a weaver's beam, and the spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, something like 15 to 20 pounds at the end of this spear. The shield bearer went before him. He stood and he shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not the Philistine? And are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel on this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Jumping up to verse 16. For 40 days, the Philistine came forward, and he took his stand, morning and evening, okay? Twice a day for 40 days. This chapter basically begins with two extended introductions of our main characters, Goliath first, and then we'll get to David in a minute. And it's something like a boxing announcer giving the stats on the two, you know, combatants about to enter the rink. Like, they're getting their introductions as they walk down through the crowd before they get to the rink. So, like, in this corner, standing just over 9 feet tall, weighing a cool 400 pounds, you know, with biceps the size of your children, carrying a spear that would require 3 mortal men to even lift it, the undefeated, super, super, extra, extra weight champion of the world, Goliath, right? The guy is walking behind him with a hoodie on and like the boombox on his shoulder playing his intro music. The tallest known man in the history of the world, recent history of the world, was a guy named Robert Wadlow. He died in 1940 and he was 8'11", all right? He would have crushed in the NBA. Goliath had him by a few inches. This whole intro for Goliath is meant to like overwhelm you, bowl you over with his size and his brawn and his height. What human can carry that much weight on his body, let alone fight in it? But here's the thing. We just came from chapter 16, And if you've been here the last 2 weeks, you know, you have heard the theme verse of David's life. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. So through this whole introduction of this giant, you're hearing it and you're impressed, but at the same time, you know it's a setup, okay? You know it's a setup. The author is setting a trap. Even now, are you overwhelmed and distracted by the external appearance of this enemy of God? Are you awed by his impressiveness, by how he looks? Even now, are you still judging by appearances? Look deeper. God is doing far more here than meets the eye. Do you have those kind of eyes of faith yet? He's setting the trap. But the over-the-top introduction is doing more work than that even, all right? Goliath is a giant, and this is not the first time the people of Israel have cowered in fear before a giant. If you remember back in the book of Numbers, we learned that when God first showed his people the land of Canaan, the land that they're standing on right now, he promised this land to his people, and he said, go in and take it. So they sent in 12 spies to spy out the land, right? So like, okay, what are we going to be up against? Let's think this through. Let's be reasonable. And the 12 spies came back, and two of them, and, oh, by the way, they saw giants in the land, okay? They saw giants roaming around, the ancestors of our character today. And two of them, Joshua and Caleb, said, okay, there's giants. They have giants. We have the promises of God. Let's do this, right? Two of them were like, let's go. But 10 of them were like, no, you didn't hear us. They're giants, okay? So the leadership was like, yeah, let's pass on the giants. And so God launched them into the wilderness to wander around for 40 years because they feared the giants who were in the land. Goliath is a giant who calls to mind that God's people have faced giants before in the very place that they were standing. The last time they fled from the giants, they wandered the wilderness for 40 years, and now for 40 days in a row, this giant comes out morning and evening and challenges them again. These things are not accidents, all right? Goliath is also announced, though, with one other feature I want to point out before we move on, okay? And that is, it doesn't come across well in the translation that we just read. We just read from the ESV. But verse 5 in the ESV said he was armed with a coat of mail. Okay, so that word for coat of mail, it is actually the word for scales, like a snake. So the NASB says he wore scale armor. The NIV says he wore a coat of scale armor of bronze. But the original Hebrew literally says Goliath wore scales. Okay, now, Goliath wasn't just a giant. He was a giant in the skin of a serpent. He was a snaky giant. He was a giant snake. And you don't have to have an Old Testament PhD to call to mind the hyperlink of another one of the people of God's greatest enemies in the Old Testament. In Genesis 3, the most ancient enemy of God slithered into the Garden of Eden and into the minds and the hearts of God's people, and he convinced them to buy into the lie that God didn't love them as much as he said he did. That life apart from God's reign would be better than life within God's reign. It was an absolute lie that the snake told, and yet we swallowed it hook, line, and sinker. Adam lost the confrontation with the snake in the garden because of his unbelief. Israel fled the confrontation with the giants because of their fear. And now, in 1 Samuel 17, this is not a one-off random story about a random giant they encountered in a valley. The author is importing all of this history of the giant problems that God's people have always faced into this moment, and he's implicitly asking, could it be different this time? Like, what would make it different this time? God's people have always faced giant problems. They always will face giant problems. We have a giant, literally a problem, in front of us. What could make this different? How will we ever get over? We've only failed in the past. If Adam failed and Moses failed, what kind of hero could win? All right? What kind of hero could win? In the other corner, David was the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah named Jesse, who had 8 sons. David was the youngest. The 3 eldest brothers in this family followed Saul, so they were off at war. But David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. So, in the other corner, the 8th and smallest son of an obscure family from Nowheresville, Israel. All right, straight from the menial field work, tending sheep, or running his side hustle, which was just running family errands back and forth through the front lines where his brothers were doing the real work, the real fighting, gaining the real glory. Easily passed over and with no actual combat experience to his name, the bookies have him at a 1 to 5,000 underdog. But that doesn't seem to bother him much. David, okay? David. The chapter, we get through these introductions, and the chapter has this interesting flow to it that I never noticed it until I was reading and rereading again this week. And this is just a side note, but I love that about the Bible. Like, I plan, Lord willing, to read the Bible for the next 4 decades of my life, and I expect that as I go over these stories that I've read 100 times, there will be endless, like, riches to mine in them. It just is so deep, right? It just goes as deep as you can give it. Anyway, the interesting thing is that we get these super heavyweight world champion pre-fight introductions. And then you do get a fight at the end, but in the middle, it's like 23 verses of like meandering conversations, and it just feels kind of random. Like, where's the story going? Like, we had such a good setup and we have such a good conclusion, but in the middle, it's like the author's like lost the thread of the story almost, it feels like. But as I was reading it this week, it struck me, no, obviously he didn't lose the thread of the story. I just didn't know where it was going. Part of what he's doing in this section is he's showing us all the different ways people react to their giant problem, okay? As David has these conversations with these different characters, we see them reacting to the giant. So consider the common ground troop. David talks with the soldiers on the ground. Verse 23. As David talked with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, he came up out of the ranks of the Philistines, and he spoke the same words as before, and David heard him. And all the men of Israel, all these ground troops, all these common guys, when they saw the man, they fled from him, and they were much afraid, okay? To be honest, like, I get these guys, you know? Like, I get them. They're not looking for a fight, right? They're just there because they were told to be there. They're trying to avoid it. They're just normal dudes thinking, look, I'm just trying to survive here, man, and there's no way I'm walking into that field with that guy. Like, that's a problem and a burden I'm not going to opt into on purpose. I'm here doing as little as possible to keep life as easy as possible. There's no way I'm taking on that problem across the valley. I'm going to wait for someone else to solve this solution. It's kind of a checking out, path of least resistance reaction to the enemy, all right? Or consider Eliab's reaction. This is David's oldest brother, the one recently passed over to be anointed as king. Verse 28. Now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the man, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David. And he said, now why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? Do you hear how bitter and cynical he is? I know what your presumptions are and the evil of your heart. You've come down to see the battle. You're just a voyeur. And David said, what have I done now? Was it not but a word that I asked these men? So David shows up at the front lines with bread and cheese for his brothers. He comes bringing literal gifts and food. He asks around to see what the hubbub is about. And Eliab's response to his younger brother is to belittle him immediately and to basically attribute the worst possible motives to him that he could. Eliab has become the cynic, hasn't he? He has become the cynic. Eugene Peterson put it like this, this approach, this reaction to our giant problems. He says their imaginations were ruined by Goliath watching, that they were incapable of seeing and accepting a simple act of friendship. The moment that we permit evil to control our imaginations, dictate the way we think, and shape our responses, we at the same time become incapable of seeing the good and the true and the beautiful in this world. Now, to be fair, like, I understand Eliab too, okay? Like, I get where he's coming from. I don't like it, especially when this cynicism kind of bubbles up in my own heart, but I understand it. He has been so immersed in the fear of that enemy for so long. And he no longer believes that he's living in like a generous world that his father God reigns over, right? He just sees everything as like the worst possible motives. He's cynical, he's pessimistic, everything is evil and dark. The idea that he lives in a good world that God reigns over and he's giving good gifts to his children, that's just not the imagination that he functions with any longer. If our first natural impulse tends towards skepticism, cynicism, pessimism, suspicion of others' motives, it's a sign that our spiritual imagination has been taken captive by the spirit of the world, right? We become cynics. Last, look at Saul's reaction to his giant problem. Remember, Saul is the sitting king. He's the one who absolutely should step into the fight of the enemy on behalf of his people. But we find him in verse 31 right here like this. All right. When the words that David spoke were heard, so David's having these conversations with the troops. He's like, well, you guys don't want to fight? I'll fight. Okay, so Saul gets word of this. They repeated them before Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. And Saul said to David, wait, you're not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him. You're but a youth, and he has been a man of war from his youth. But David said to Saul, your servant used to keep sheep for his father, and when there came a lion or a bear, and he took a lamb from the flock, I went after him and struck him and delivered it out of his mouth. And if he arose against me, I caught him by, imagine this, caught him by his beard and struck him and killed him. David's a 16-year-old dude out there in the field grabbing lions by the beard just because he took one of his sheep. Your servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them. He's calling the enemies of God beasts, right? For he has defied the army of the living God. And David said, the Lord, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said to David, go, and the Lord be with you. Okay, like you talked me into it. The fight's yours, buddy. Good luck. But then, this is fascinating, verse 38, Saul clothed David with his armor. He put a helmet of bronze on his head, clothed him with a coat of mail, and David strapped his sword over his armor, and he tried in vain to go, for he had not tested them. And then David said to Saul, look, I can't go with these. I've not tested them. So David put them off. All right, pause the story right there. This is Saul's reaction to the enemy. The enemy's tall. I'm tall too, though. That's why I became king, right? He has armor. I have armor too. I'm king. He's a champion in war. I've been a champion in war too, right? They sing songs about me. And yet, in this scene, we find Saul not fighting the battle. He's called to fight, but hunkered down in his war room, unwilling to fight. And if I'm being honest, I get Saul too, okay? Like, I understand where he's coming from. He has fallen into this trap of believing that he can outfight and out-hustle the enemy in his own strength. That he has a chance of working and strategizing a way out of this mess. It has worked in the past. Maybe it will work again. Maybe I can pull another miracle out of my hat this time when the giant enemy comes my way. And yet, at some point for Saul, and at some point for all of us, we encounter problems that are so gigantic, we just can't anymore, can we? And at that point, we just become weary. We become just broken, like defeated, like we're just hunkered down in our little war room, still kind of strategizing, but it's like, man, I can't do it. Like, I'm done with the hustle. I gave it my best, and I can't. And that's where we find Saul. Peter Lightheart is a theologian, and he made this comment, which I thought was fascinating. For the rest of 1 Samuel, so for the rest of Saul's life in this story that we find him in the Bible, we will almost always see him with a spear in his hand. Okay? He has adopted the way of the world around him, becoming more like Goliath than God, adopting the way of the Philistines, not the way of the Lord. He's a fighter, and he's going to do it in his own strength, whether he can do it or not, all the way to the end. So Saul, in his weariness, tries to pass this same strategy off to David. He's like, hey, this guy has armor. Take this armor. You're going to need this. This is how you fight these battles. But David is like, I'm going a different direction. Okay? I'm going to go a different way. Eugene Peterson sums up the scene. A bullying might or a fearful right? Brutal Goliath or anxious Saul? Two tall kings that seem like the only two ways of the world until David, kneeling, unhurried, and calm, a non-anxious presence in the midst of complete chaos and anxiety, opened up another option, God's way of salvation. Okay? Verse 40, David took his staff in his hand And he chose five smooth stones from the brook, and he put them in his shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. Goliath fought with traditional strength. David approached him like a shepherd. He's got a stick in one hand and a sling in the other hand, no armor to speak of, and he's kneeling down in the stream before his battle. It is the antithesis of power. David stepped into that fight in weakness. Verse 41. And the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistines looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. And the Philistine, it's interesting, he loses his name after a while, and he's just called the Philistine, said to David, "Am I a dog that you come to me with sticks?" And the Philistine cursed David by his gods. The Philistine said to David, "Come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air, to the beasts of the field." Then David said to the Philistine, "You come to me with a sword and a spear and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves, not with sword and spear. For the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand." When the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. David put his hand into his bag. You can see it in your mind's eye, okay? He put his hand into his bag, took out a stone, slung it, and struck the Philistine square in the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell on his face to the ground. Probably not dead yet, just stunned, worst concussion of his life. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone. And he struck the Philistine and he killed him. There was no sword in the hand of David. And then David ran and stood over the Philistine, took his own sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. When the Philistines saw their champion was dead, they fled. All right, one of the most epic scenes in the whole Bible. It's so good. In verse 4 and verse 23, Goliath is described as the champion, right? The champion. The word is from Hebrew that they translate as champion is literally, it means the man in the middle, okay? Interesting. He stands in the valley between the armies, Goliath does. And then he says, I'm the Philistine, right? Like, in other words, I represent all the Philistines. I am them. They are me. I am their representative. As my fate goes in this battle, so goes the fate of a nation, all that I represent. And then when David steps into that same valley, he represents Israel in the exact same way. He is their champion. He's the man in the middle. As his fate goes, the nation's fate goes. As his future goes, so goes the future of an entire people. He is them. They are him. Their future hung on the shoulders of their shepherd king as he walked out to fight the battles that they were too weary or too afraid or too cynical to fight on their own. And when he won, they won. In their fear, they still won through their man in the middle, right? In their cynicism, they still were victorious through their representative who walked into that field on their behalf. In their weary hustle, they still won through a champion who could take on the enemies that they could not, winning in weakness. Okay, so back to the opening question. Where do you see yourself in this story? Of all the characters we've surveyed so far, who are you most like? It's tempting, this is my temptation, to want to be David, right? I want to be David. To hear the story like this and to leave with sort of like a self-help motivational, like get out there and slay the dragons in your life and slay the giants in your life. But let's be honest, or I'll just be honest, I'll speak for me, not you. I am much more likely to be Saul, right? Fighting with the same old strategy as the world and just weary. I'm much more likely to be Eliab, the cynic. You can't fool me. I see through what's going on here, except to see through everything is the same as not to see, isn't it? Or the soldiers, man, I'm just here trying to survive. No ambition of greatness for the kingdom, no real plan either. If I could just check out and not engage, I certainly would, but that doesn't seem to be an option here, so I'm going to do as little as I can, avoid the danger, path of least resistance. But I hope you see that this event in the life of the anointed King David offers you a preview of another way to face the giant problems that we all face in this life. The message of David and Goliath is that there is a representative, that there is a man in the middle who steps into the valley on behalf of his people and wins the battles, takes on the giants that we in our power could never take on our own. We could never win those wars on our own. We don't have the strength. It's easy to see David and Goliath as a self-help pep talk, but we don't need self-help, right? We need like hero help. We don't need to slay the giant. We need someone to slay the giant for us. Jesus Christ addresses the giant needs of our world. He defeats the enemies that all of us are too small and powerless to address on our own. So when he went to the cross, he took on the giant problems of sin reigning in the world, of an enemy that's too strong for any of us to address alone, the lies that Satan throws at his people. He represented us in that moment. He was the man in the middle. He is us, and we are him. What he won that day, he won for us. And later, 3 days later, after that battle, living his resurrection life, our victory was sealed and delivered for eternity. We all face giant problems in this world. We live in a world damaged by sin. And this is enemy-held territory, and it will be until the day Jesus returns. But imagine the difference. Imagine this difference of walking through your life and all of these problems and difficulties that you face, and setbacks and fears and disappointments in life, walking through your life, encountering those, knowing you have a champion fighting on your behalf. Like you are not alone in that valley. There is a representative, a man in the middle, who will walk in with you, who will win those battles for you, and then he'll invite you into the victory that he has already won on your behalf. How great is verse 52 at the end of this whole story. The men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout, okay, this is after Goliath falls, rose with a shout and pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron, so that the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Shiram and as far as Gath of Ekron. Here's what it's saying. It's not that these guys did nothing. They just did nothing until the victory was already over, okay? Like these fearful Israelites did nothing until the war was won, and then they were all in. They were like, let's go get them, boys. Like the champion's down. It's time to win. It's like the battle was already won, but they're in at that point, okay? They were invited into the victory, and they were invited back into the game, and they did it. They ran after their champion, and they followed him to victory. Their salvation was in no way their accomplishment, but they enjoyed the spoils of the war nonetheless. And so can you, okay? And so can you. Christ, our Shepherd King, is the champion of our souls. And he is calling you to follow in the wake of his victory. He has won it all on your behalf. You can rest in him. Are you in? All right? Are you in? Let's pray. Heavenly Father, thanks for this great story, this true story. But it's so much bigger than just a man-on-man fight in the Valley of Elah, 1000 BC. This is our story. We are in this story. And it is such a gift of your gospel, such a gift of grace, such generosity that we do not have to face the giant problems of our lives alone. That even in our fear, in our cynicism, in our weariness, you are our champion and you will carry us through this life into victory and into all the riches of your kingdom. So God, help us trust in you, in Jesus, our man in the middle, our representative. Help us just enjoy and relish all that he has won for us on the cross and in his resurrection. We ask these things in your name. Amen.